Welcome, friends. Welcome to our cast. I'm your host, Ron Jacobs, bringing you a fount of knowledge of architecture and wonderful things from my friends at Patterns and Practices. You know, I used to be on the Patterns and Practices team, and on today's episode, we are going to bring you a blast from the past. Not that far, September 2005. Okay, but we were talking about some things in the future tense at that time that are now shipping reality. That's what I love about Patterns and Practices. They get stuff done, get it out there quick. And this topic is about web services security patterns, which is a wonderful piece of work you will really enjoy. And we have a whole bunch of content coming on this, so you'll want to listen in for those. So sit back, relax, as we tune in to Jason Hogg and Fred Chong talking about web services security patterns. From Studio One here at Microsoft Studios, we are delighted to bring you the Web Services Security Patterns edition of Patterns and Practices Live. And as you can probably tell from the title slide, Don Smith is not with us any longer. No, just kidding. He bailed on us today. I guess he had something to do, you know.
Very like short notice.
Get a haircut or something. I don't know. But anyway, no, that's okay because Fred Chong, who's also a member of the team and a great security dude, has volunteered to step in and kind of fill Don's shoes today. So thanks, Fred, for coming. All right. And also joined by Jason Hogg. How's it going?
Good. Very good.
Okay, great. So today we're going to be diving into this issue about security. So I guess there is some security, right? I mean, we have to have security. Security is a good thing.
Security is a good thing. It's a fairly dry subject, though. So what we're going to try to do is actually not stay deep the whole time. We're going to try and do a couple of demos, walk through some scenarios, and try to keep the talk interesting.
Okay, and because that's good. Interesting is always better. Now, security has always been a critical thing, but you know, sometimes people, I find a lot of people just go, well, you know, I'm not too concerned about security. It's all inside our firewall or whatever. And so, you know, we'll just kind of get to that later. But what are some of the key things that people really need to think about, Fred, in terms of the security?
Well, I think there is a rule called the actually not a rule, but really people in the security industry think of these three things as the gold standard of security. The reason why they are called the gold standard is because they all starts with A. If you remember your maybe high school periodic tables. A is a symbol for gold, so they're...
Yeah, actually, I had forgotten that. Yeah.
So they're authentication, authorization, and auditing are really the first three things you should be thinking about.
Okay.
Beyond that, you should also think about how to protect your data from people who are not supposed to look into the data through techniques like encryption, et cetera, et cetera. Then beyond that, you have other things that are caused by, you know, other scripts kiddies or nuisance things like viruses, where you should think about patch management, how to deploy your server securely, especially when people are deploying web services. These web services are typically deployed in sort of the internet-facing zone, so they really have to think about secure deployment very carefully.
Now, it seems that those pesky government types have also complicated things a bit, haven't they?
You know what? Isn't that just typical? A couple of large companies go bankrupt, and what do?
Yeah, they make all of our lives miserable.
Yeah. So at the same time, there's obviously, there are regulations such as Sarbanes-Oxley, HIPAA, and I think in California, there's some Personal Privacy Information Acts and so forth, that are also making companies think a lot more about how data should be protected, how access to data should be audited, and how actually changes in user rights and so forth should also be audited. But that's not all. Yeah. Now we've got this whole new era of web services, where we're actually exposing business functionality potentially to partners across the internet. How on earth do you go about securing that? And similarly, you may actually be working with partners whose services you're consuming. So you probably also want to make sure that when you're consuming their services, that you're doing that in a secure manner as well.
Oh, right. You know, so in fact, I remember a couple of years ago going over to Europe and all of the customers over there were all over this already because the EU was even at that time having a lot of regulation. But now we've kind of caught up over here in the U.S. So all right. So
we have products, right? That's what we do, Microsoft. We have lots of products, and we kind of help you do these things. And so, Fred, what kind of products do we have that help this?
Well, currently, if you look at what we have on MSDN, MSWizzy 2.0 has already been released for a while. And for people who have already played with WizzY 2.0, you realize that we have actually implemented a lot of standards there, things like WS Security, WS Secure Conversation, WS Trust. They are all implemented, and what we provide in that toolkit is really a layer of programmer's abstraction where people don't really have to think about the protocols as it is right now. They only have to think about what the APIs is to get the security functionality.
Okay, so now just for our people, there may be some people on the webcast who go, what's WizzY? It's not like something that comes included in .NET Framework, is it? Something extra you have to go get?
Yes, it does not come. It's not something that you buy with Visual Studio. It's an extra component that you download from MSDN, the MSDN website.
Okay, so you go to the Web Services Developer Center, I think it is, and you can get it from there.
Yeah.
And then there's going to be a new version of WizzY coming right out with .NET 2.0 and Visual Studio 2005 very soon.
Exactly, that's WizzY 3.
Yeah. And it's improved some over WizzY 2, right?
Well, WizzY 3, what they've done is, after spending a lot of time talking to customers, they've realized there's a couple of sort of four or five main scenarios that people are developing against when they're building the web services. So they've actually encapsulated those scenarios in what they call standard bindings or assertions, which we'll take a look at later, but they definitely make it a lot easier to use. The other thing I should mention, Fred mentioned a lot of WS words, WS Security, WS Secure Conversation, WS Trust. We've spoken about that a little bit in the past on some of our WSI presentations. But if anyone's interested, we do have a backup slide number 28. So ping Ron during the presentation, and at the end we can come to that slide
oh, sure.
and walk through how that stack looks like. So
okay, great. And then there's and then of course the world will get much, much better, and world hunger will be solved, and all the survivors of Hurricane Katrina will be in wonderful shape when Indigo is released out in the future, right?
Absolutely. And I think the great news for I don't know how many of our audience are actually going to the PDC next week, but I believe there's going to be a lot of presentations about Indigo, lots of exciting stuff happening there. So.
Okay. Well, great. All right. So, but we do have some challenges. You know, we can't wait for everything out in the future, but we got to do some stuff today. Some of the challenges we're dealing with are what?
Well, it's funny because it's not just about technology, right? You really have to understand what your business and what your security requirements are in order to start thinking about how to use products.
Yeah. Jason mentioned the non-technology part of it, but I'm a technologist, so I'm going to talk about the technology, what technology can help. When you look at the kind of spectrum of security technology out there, there's so many buzzwords out there. You get SAML, you get WS, you get Liberty Alliance, and so on and so forth thrown at you. It's really confusing as far as trying to figure out what sort of technology to use. Just to list a few sort of like minimum thing that you should be thinking about, different organizations have different kind of authentication technology that are deployed. Today, some people have Active Directory, some have their Sun LDAP. And it's important for us when we are talking about guidance and telling people to do web services security that we don't tell people to rip and replace what they have. We want to tell them how they can make use of their existing investment. The same thing applies for things like authorization. A lot of people have custom role-based schemes deployed in their infrastructure today. Some are looking for new things. And with us, we have the Windows Authorization Manager framework, which is a great role-based technology. We want to also tell people how to integrate that sort of framework into their solutions.
Okay, so, you know, since there's a lot of how-to questions on here, it kind of reminded me of a project that one of our colleagues is doing. And let me just bring this up in a web slide. This is at msdn.microsoft.com/security-guidance. And
nice. That's a bad rating he's got there, right?
Let's see. Okay, there it goes. All right. Yep. All right. See, look at that. 9 out of 9. Everybody loves this guidance site. So there's a whole bunch of security guidance for how to use secure solutions and a bunch of security engineering guidelines, but my favorite part of these how-tos, you know, so like how to call a web service using a client certificate, how to call a web service using SSL, whole bunch of stuff like that. So this is a great resource, msdn.microsoft.com/security-guidance. So just wanted to throw that in there because I think that's a great resource. And this has actually been updated for .NET 2.0. So you notice there are some here that's .NET Framework 1.1, and then there's some for .NET 2.0. So hope that people will take a look at that as well. But I digress.
No, that's very cool. I've never seen an advert in a webcast before.
Well, you know, JD offered to give me a few bucks if I slid that in there. So anyway, but, you know, one of the things I think that's interesting about this project you guys are doing is that sometimes patterns get like you have to read a whole book of patterns before you know anything. Right. And you got to study like all these patterns and get them all in your head. And every now and then you run into, like, we have a colleague who's like this, David Trowbridge, and you go, hey, David, is there a pattern that does blah, blah, blah? And he'll go, oh, yeah, that's the FUBAR pattern, you know? And you go, man, how does he know this? Because he just, crazy, like, lives in those things. But you know, your normal person probably can't do that. So how did you guys address this?
That's a great question. So we, and I think you actually mentioned a couple of good words, because it's like pattern guides are typically not something you can even read. You typically have to study them, apply the problem, and at that point, sometime in the future, when you want to solve a certain problem, a pattern will spring to mind, like what you just mentioned David can do. Mm-hmm. So what we've tried to do is actually make the patterns within the guidance more accessible. And the way we're doing that is by having two or three different ways to navigate to the patterns. One is through demonstrating application of certain patterns through scenarios that we hope will resonate with customers. And we'll actually walk through one of those scenarios shortly. Another approach that we're having is essentially a series of questions and answers that help you refine your understanding of the problems you're trying to solve and then point you to some patterns that would be good starting points to actually help essentially know how to solve your problem.
Yeah, essentially. So once we did a preview with a customer by walking through the set of requirements and the questions with him, and at the end of that exercise, he basically concluded that, so, Fred, you guys are trying to ship a security consultant in a box. I said, well, not quite close, but that's the goal, but then it's a challenging goal, but that's what we're trying to take the load off the non-security experts by offering a set of requirements, walking them through a set of security requirements as well as constraints that they have to deal with when they're thinking about their security decision. Hopefully, they don't have to think too hard. It's kind of like just filling out a template with a yes or no type or maybe some gray area answers that they can derive a solution based on the set of question and answers exercise.
Yeah, so what you guys have done is you kind of written these patterns up at sort of different levels. And I like this because this is something that you know, Patterns and Practices has done for a long time. But so Jason, you have here like at the architecture level, you know, in terms of authentication, you can sort of have direct authentication or brokered authentication. And then you kind of break it down into different options for the design and implementation, right? So is this helping people to really understand what's going on here?
I think it's helping people in two ways. One, you can actually visually just sort of identify sort of certain relationships between patterns. So, for example, the brokered authentication patterns. In that case, when you actually read the pattern, you'll get a better sense. But it's talking about how you actually trust a third party to essentially broker authentication between a client and a requester. And there's three different approaches you can actually do that we're describing. One using Kerberos, one using an X509 certificate authority, and another using a SAML security token service. The other great benefit with this approach to factoring the guidance is that we've actually separated the design and architectural guidance from the product-specific implementation guidance. And that what that means is it's very easy for us to update the content for WSI 2, for WSI 3, and for Indigo. And the schema or the way in which we're describing the actual patterns doesn't need to change at all. So we'll still be talking about direct authentication when we do the WSI 3 version and when we do the Indigo version, but the implementation patterns will change.
You know, what I like about this is because, you know, just yesterday I was reading a document about new features in a unnamed Microsoft product, let's say. And it's like a 40-page document, and immediately they dove right into details about, well, we have this feature, and it kind of works this way, and this feature goes that way. And it was like they started describing that bottom layer of implementation. And I was going, you know, I don't even understand what this is for. So I was missing that top layer of understanding what we were trying to do before you tell me about how you do it.
You know, that's another reason why patents are such a great way to give guidance. Quite often, the documentation that comes with products does talk about features. It explains how to use features within a product, and that makes a lot of sense. Whereas patents are recurring solutions to common problems. So that means they're more likely to gel and resonate with people building systems.
Yeah, right? Exactly.
Another way to look at this is we're trying to teach people how to fish and not just give you a flavor of the fish.
Ah, okay, yeah. So, there you go. And it's probably a sushi, right?
Fred, actually, for the people who didn't know, Fred had sushi for breakfast this morning.
Okay, all right. So you have a bunch of patterns here that we've covered in this thing. You have a thingy
we have written, right?
And is it, what is it?
The thingy is available. So right now, the thingy is, it's narrative, it's text-based guidance. There's two ways that we're providing sort of early access to the content. One through a CHM, which makes actually navigating through links within the content much simpler. And also as Word documents, if people are more interested in that. It'll also be available as HTML on MSDN when we go live sometime around November.
Okay, so we're going to have the URL a little bit later, but so this is more or less just stuff that you read, right? It's not like a code library or something that you're going to go and.
That's right. We'll take a look at that shortly. What we've got on the screen right now is a list of the patterns that are likely to be actually included in the guide. Uh-huh. I say likely to be included because we're right now at that sort of point where dev resources, the budget for dev resources has run out, and we're actually trying to compile everything into the final documentation.
Okay.
But just at the highest level for the WYSI 3 release of this guidance.
No, wait a minute, though.
Whoa.
Dev resources? This is just like a paper. Why do you need dev resources?
That's a great question, actually. You know, when I first started at Microsoft, it actually surprised me how much work goes into creating content. We actually have subject matter experts like Fred who have actually helped us in the security space. We've got developers that are already experts at WYSI 3. We've got the WYSI 3 team actually helping us review the guidance. We've got test resources. We've actually got external security firms that are specialized in security reviews doing the testing of the guidance. There's an awful lot of work goes into creating packages like this.
Oh, so when you write about a pattern, you guys have actually like built it?
We've built it. We've tested it. We've had subject matter experts review it. And hopefully that makes our consumers a lot more able to solve their problems more easily.
Oh, okay. I like that. Okay, very much. All right. So here's kind of the scenario thinking, and I really like this because scenarios make it easy for people to identify their situation. They go, oh, yeah, that looks like the kind of app I'm building. That's my scenario. So kind of walk us through this scenario here. What's going on with this one?
Well, the scenario that we have on the screen is an intranet scenario. And what we're looking at here is we think of as maybe a good representation of the kind of intranet line of business application that people would build. In this case, it's an intranet banking application that the customer service representative may, you know, bring up to service their customers. In order to use this banking applications, they have basically, first thing they have to do is to log on to the banking applications. And what we're looking at here is really an intranet scenario. Why is intranet important here? Because it does put certain environmental constraint into a scenario, such as we assume that things would all be within the internal firewall so you don't run into firewall restrictions.
Now, hang on just a second, though. What if somebody says, like, well, I'm not building a bank application. Does this scenario apply?
Well, so that's I think we actually have a bucket of scenarios that they can relate to. This is just one of the kind of scenarios.
But this isn't. There's nothing in here that's specific to a bank, right?
It's really, we just needed some context, something to make it interesting. It could be a health company. It could be an entertainment company.
So anybody who's building like some kind of standard intranet application that's going to use web services, talk to a database, that's a very, very common scenario, right?
Yeah.
So that's what this feels like, right?
Yeah. If you look at the scenario there, first of all, the observation is that there are a few tiers in the solution. And then I also mentioned the assumption that there's it's operating within the corporate firewalls.
Mm-hmm.
So from that, you can further derive other things, such as if given that the banking application, you might want to assume that you need to protect data that are transiting within the network, that you need to protect it from people looking into data, so you might want to have encryption and signing and so on and so forth.
So this is kind of like you were saying, the security guide in a box, the consultant in a box, right? Because this is, if they had you, Fred, come in and sit down and talk to them, and this was the scenario, you'd be telling them this basic story right
exactly.
here, right?
Exactly.
And so we can save you a trip, and they get something a lot faster, right? So that's pretty good. So you have kind of here the constraints of the environment, and you say, well, okay, based on what you've got, here's what we're going to do. And then now you've got some considerations you were talking about earlier. Kind of talk me through what these are. So, for example, authentication, because it's inside the corporate environment, we can just use Active Directory and Kerberos?
Yes. So if you look at authentication just as a consideration, we could make the assumption that since it's within the corporate firewalls, you know, Kerberos is a viable solution because it requires non-standard ports, like port 88.
All right.
And that's not a problem because you're within the corporate firewalls. And then if you look at the examples, so you could potentially come up with a requirement that the message data is sensitive and must be protected against unauthorized access. So with Kerberos, you can get a token that you can actually derive a keys and use it for encryption purposes to protect the data while it's being in transit. So what we do here is that using the scenario, we walk you through this list of considerations and talk about what are the things that you should be thinking about given your constraints and your requirements at the technology level.
Okay, and so we kind of give you this high level, here's what a solution looks like, but then it boils down to some patterns. And so you're saying for this scenario, there are some patterns we should use. So Jason, what kind of patterns?
So at the top here, we've got this idea of brokered authentication. So that's almost like an architectural pattern. And we mentioned before that there are actually a couple of different ways you can actually trust a third party to help broker authentication. One was using S559, the other was using SAML, and the other was using Kerberos. So the approach for the considerations we discussed earlier is we're going to use the brokered authentication using Kerberos pattern. We're also going to, based on some of the requirements, use the data confidentiality and the data origin authentication pattern. Data origin authentication helps support data integrity. And actually what we're going to do is rather than actually creating implementation patterns for each of these individually and then leaving it to developers to compile it in their own mind as they try to solve this problem, we've got this concept of what we call composite patterns, where the actual implementation pattern demonstrates more than one design pattern. So we've got one implementation pattern that actually shows you not only how to authenticate, but also how to sign and encrypt if you want to.
Oh, okay. So that saves some time.
Yeah. One of the other things we should mention, I think in a few slides back, we said that sometimes it's very hard to think about solutions in terms of patterns because then we assume that you have to read all these patterns before you can come up with the solutions. In this case, what we're doing is also we're using the sample scenarios to help you relate to something that you are working on and then talk you through the solution, but then have a backlink into the patterns. And so if you're really interested in knowing how to fish, you could actually, well, you don't have to fish to get that fish. You can start with the fish and then go back and find out how to fish that fish if you want it to. And that's the backlink into the patterns.
Yeah, or you can just open a can of tuna.
Oh, you can use dynamite, right? I saw that on The Simpsons the other day. Was it South Park?
All right. So no, but I like this because, you know, for me, I'm very much, I like to think the top down. So I would probably go, okay, well, here's my scenario because we're all so busy. I don't have time to read about all of those. I'm going to look at the scenario and then I would go, okay, so you guys are recommending brokered authentication. Then I might go and just read, well, what is brokered authentication? What is data confidentiality and how does it help meet the requirement? So then I would feel comfortable enough that I know kind of what we're intending on doing. Then I can drill down into, well, okay, how are we actually going to implement that? And if I were serving in the role of architect on the team, I don't need to get into all the details of how it's implemented. I give that to my devs and I say, you guys go and make that happen, right? But what's great about this is I could approach the security with a lot of confidence knowing that, you know, I have a good solution that's tested, that's well known. So in this little diagram here, you're talking about and this is, I assume, from the pattern book, right, that you're talking about how this brokered authentication is done with the Kerberos.
That's exactly right. So we probably won't spend too much time on this because we'll actually go through in the actual CHM shortly. But essentially, the banking application, which is a smart client application, so somebody's already logged on. So you're typically using their credentials to access what's called a service ticket, which is what allows you to actually authenticate against the web service that the smart client app's actually talking to. That same ticket can also be used, as Fred mentioned. You can get a drive key and sign and encrypt messages and all that sort of great stuff. Some of that stuff will be interesting, some of it won't. The pattern you can actually work out, you can go straight to the code if that's all you're interested in, or you can better understand what's going on under the covers. So we do actually describe how these interactions work under the covers. And the great thing with understanding what goes on under the covers is when you have to troubleshoot, you're much better, you're in a better position to troubleshoot.
Okay. All right. Show me some code. All right, because we want to see this now. All right, because we do actually have some code because, like you said, we spent money on development. So why don't you go ahead and go to the next sharing slide and let's see that.
All right, that sounds good. Just remind me, which icon do I need to press to share?
It's that down blue button.
I'm sorry. Yep.
Yeah, there you go. Excellent.
All right, so what we've got here is... I mentioned earlier, we're going to have probably three different ways you can actually get this content when it's finally released. One will be in a PDF. One will be as HTML on MSDN. And this is an approach that we're actually testing because we think that the patterns, because there's so many links between content within the guidance, that it makes sense to try to actually provide an environment where you can take advantage of those links. So right now we've also got a package as a CHM.
Are you thinking of doing the other one where it goes into the Visual Studio shell and all
that's
that?
That's longer term what we'd like to do as well.
Yeah, okay. So this is great, though, for if you're offline, like on an airplane or something, and you got to link around in it, it's pretty good.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Mm-hmm. So, and right now we've got probably about half of the patterns in here. We've been doing monthly drops. So on our workspace, this is the August release. So we've got a little bit of the content in here. So as we mentioned earlier, we've got a couple of different ways we can navigate the content. Right now what we've got is, if you remember the diagram that we spoke about earlier that actually showed the authentication patterns, this actually includes an approach where you can actually better understand what the difference between direct and brokered authentication is. And then what it does is give you some factors to consider that would help you work out whether you're swaying towards direct or brokered authentication. And then once you've actually gone through that list, you've then got a pretty good sense of, well, you know what, if I'm going to do brokered authentication, then what I need to start thinking about is, well, you guys mentioned a whole lot of different ways we can do brokered authentication between X509, Kerberos, SAML, and so forth. Similarly, we've got these considerations. So this is the consultant in the box, if you will, that Fred mentioned. This is...
Or if somebody just wanted to make a lot of money, they could take this and learn it real well and then go be a consultant.
You know what? Hopefully a lot of consultants will. So that's one of the approaches that we could take to navigating. The other I mentioned was this use of scenarios. So the scenario that we described earlier, we've got within here. And what we do straight up front is basically say, you know what, these are the patterns that the actual scenario demonstrates. And then we walk through very similar content to what you saw earlier. I say very similar because I actually cut and pasted it because... I'm very unoriginal. So you can see, so that's the scenario. So if we actually, and this is again the benefit of actually using the CHM, is we can actually click straight on the brokered authentication pattern. Now the brokered authentication pattern is a high-level pattern, it's an architectural pattern, if you will. And what we've got within this is context, which essentially establishes some background, which is important to think about why we're even thinking about authentication. Then we've got some forces. Forces are requirements, if you will, things that must be important to you if you're actually going to consider using this pattern. But let's actually jump down a level deeper even, and let's go and take a look at the brokered authentication using Kerberos. So you can see you can also navigate through the CHM and go straight to brokered authentication or do what we're going to do. And right now we've got, this is sort of a derivative of the brokered authentication pattern, which is brokered authentication using Kerberos. So again, in this case, you can see the requirements are actually more specific. Your organization wants to take advantage of enterprise single sign-on. You want to use a centralized authentication resource rather than having every application build its own authentication mechanism. All that sort of good stuff. Then what we've got in this design pattern is basically a description of how Kerberos and Active Directory work together and the steps within that, which we won't drill into right now because we've got more interesting things to do. What we can then do is take a look at the implementation pattern.
Oh, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry, but we're out of time.
You know, some people have said to me, Ron, I have a fast pipe. I have a big MP3 player. Just put the whole thing in there. But, you know, I think a half hour feels about right, you know? Because if you're on that long commute and, well, you know, if it was an hour, you probably don't have an hour to sit still and listen. So I'm going to give it to you in half hour chunks, okay? But never fear, because the second half of this wonderful webcast is coming tomorrow, to be followed by 3 more webcasts, 6 ArtCast episodes, in which we go into great detail about securing web services with X509 certificates, Kerberos tokens, and username tokens. Hey, I learned a lot, and you will too. When you listen to ArtCast, send me a note to ron.jacobs@microsoft.com. See you next time.